Mock left the bar and rushed to join Napier as they all left the room, two bodyguards in front of them, with two more bringing up the rear. The Asian seemed about to speak, but Napier cut him off, raising a finger to his lips. He strained for any further sounds of gunfire and heard nothing from the night outside. Napier was on the verge of hoping it had been a fluke, the product of a nervous trigger finger, when all hell broke loose. It sounded as if half a dozen automatic weapons had begun to fire in unison. The sounds were coming from all around him, not just from the south side of the house, where the initial shots had echoed moments earlier. His bodyguards drew weapons without waiting for the order. They were pros, and knew when it was time to shift from words to action. Napier was encouraged by the hardware in their hands, but he lost the feeling in a hurry when he thought about the odds against them. Andrastas had close to 50 armed men on the island, outnumbering Napier's team by more than 10-1. So why were they shooting outside, he asked himself, frowning at the illogic of it. No ruse was required if Andrastas had decided to take them out. Quite the opposite, in fact, since the gunfire put Napier's men on alert, and it would have been easier to lull them with a false sense of security and take them by surprise. Napier was still grappling with that riddle when their escort brought them to a door, knocked twice, and entered without waiting for a summons. Napier urged his shooters through the doorway, following close on their heels. He found Andrastas standing in a room that resembled an arsenal, cradling a semi-automatic shotgun in his arms.
Christus, what the hell?
We have intruders, I'm afraid. I see your men already. Good. If you need anything before you go, please help yourselves. But quickly, if you will. There may be little time.
That's twice I've heard that. I don't know what you got in mind, but I'm telling you right...
I was thinking of survival. You presumably have no objection on that score?
You told me we were safe here, Christus.
Yes, safe.
Andrastas scanned their faces with his clear gray eyes, a thin smile turning up the corners of his mouth.
Unfortunately, it seems I was mistaken.
The troops were in a hurry, rushing through the forest, chasing sounds of gunfire. It was only natural for them to overlook the woman dressed in black, her face darkened by cosmetics, crouching in the shadows off to one side of the trail. They could have been forgiven for the oversight, but there was no forgiveness in the cards this night. Rebecca Mindel let them pass her by, then shot them from behind. The bursts from her Kalashnikov dropped the runners sprawling on their faces. She moved out, tracking the sounds of combat, wondering if Blansky or McCarter had run afoul of the Greek's private army. More lights were coming on around the house, blazing under the eaves and along flagstone walks through the garden and over the large swimming pool. The glare picked out soldiers in silhouette, sprinting here and there to their duty stations, communicating by hand signals in lieu of spoken words. Mindel admired their efficiency in the abstract, but it wouldn't stop her from killing them if they gave her half a chance. Rapid firing away to her right marked the point where Blansky should have been. He was catching hell from the sound of it, and giving as good as he got. The storm of fire drew several defenders away from their stations, rushing to join in the action, and Mindel took advantage of the gap in their line, working closer to the house. She pushed off from the tree line, jogging across the neatly manicured lawn, cutting glances to left and right as she ran. She was halfway to the patio and pool before anyone seemed to notice.
Here! She's over here!
It was a lookout posted near a utility shed, some 50 feet beyond the pool. He rose, shouldering his weapon as Mindel dropped into a crouch. Her stubby AKSU had the same range as its parent AK-74, but the much shorter barrel made long-distance accuracy a challenge. Mindel took the extra second to frame her target in the rifle's sights. She stitched him with half a dozen rounds from close to 90 feet away. The impact pitched him over backwards, smashing into the shed, leaving broad crimson smears on beige paint as the dead man surrendered to gravity, slithering down to the turf. It bought her time, but not enough to dawdle, as his backup caught the drift of what was happening and moved to close the trap. A couple of the stragglers running off toward Blansky's stretch of the perimeter turned back to find a target they could see. Choices. She could retreat and seek cover in the woods, or press on over open ground to reach the house. It was no choice at all.
Sons of bitches!
Running and firing from the hip, Mindel advanced on her objective, on the men who'd killed her uncle and could never wash the bloodstains from their hands. Christos Andrastas let his houseman lead the way, followed by half a dozen mercenaries, six more bringing up the rear behind his party of seven. The Greek's first impulse had been to kill Napier's bodyguards while the oil man watched, then fling Napier and Lynn Mock into the night to let them live or die on their own. But his rational mind had won out, reminding him that his partners might still be useful as bargaining chips. Alive, perhaps they could be traded for his own safe passage. Dead? Well, there was always time for that. His predecessor on the island had been paranoid, with good reason, as it turned out, and one of his architectural surprises was an escape tunnel leading from the house to a separate garage. Cars were unnecessary on Tira, where a healthy man could walk the island's length in 20 minutes, but the garage housed a variety of smaller vehicles, including three electric carts for hauling luggage from the pier up to the house. More importantly, the garage was located downhill from the house and 100 yards distant, invisible from the villa proper and outside the perimeter of gunfire now circling his home. If Andrastis could make it that far, with his escort intact, he had a chance of reaching the Aristotle and sailing away from Tira before his enemies noticed. Napier and Mach were welcome to come along for the ride, but they'd be disembarking before he reached Athens, along with their gunmen. He would give them to the Med. They reached the kitchen pantry with its special cupboard slotted in among the others. Andrastis nodded to his houseman, watching Napier's face as the cupboard was opened, a secret catch released, and the entire wall of shelves swung outward to reveal a narrow staircase leading downward into darkness. At the touch of a switch, fluorescent lights flared to illuminate the staircase and the tunnel mouth below.
Oh, you're kidding, right?
Hardly, Mr. Napier. It's our way out to safety. If you'd rather stay and fight, of course, I'll understand.
No, thank you.
Where does this go?
It will take us indirectly to the Aristotle.
Indirectly?
Tunneling between the house and harbor proved too difficult, I'm told. We're wasting precious time, Arnold.
So we just sail away?
A simple cruise. We can return after my people deal with the intruders.
If they do.
Have faith, my friend. And hurry, if you please.
You first.
Of course, Mr. Napier.
Andrastis let his houseman lead the way, then followed him downstairs, the shotgun heavy in his hands. Behind him followed Mach and Napier with their armed contingent, mercenaries bringing up the rear to cut off any last-minute retreat. They reached the bottom of the stairs and stood before the tunnel's mouth. Even with lights, it still remained an uninviting place, a serpent's yawning throat.
I don't like tunnels.
By all means, go back to the game room then and make yourself at home.
You said this place was safe, Andrastis.
It always has been in the past. I'm forced to ask myself how we were found. Perhaps you left a trail, my friend. Perhaps you're not as careful and as efficient as you claim to be.
Now wait a minute.
You have a choice to make, Arnold. Accompany me or stay behind. In either case, make up your mind. I won't stand here and argue while your enemies draw closer every minute.
My enemies? Listen,
stay or go, decide now.
Lead on.
A wise choice.
Andrastis turned and stepped into the tunnel's mouth. All followed. Lin Mach didn't like tunnels either, but he had seen the futility of arguing with Andrastis about their escape route, the folly of remaining behind while gunfire raked the house and grounds. In spirit, he was already aboard the Aristotle. Anything was better than remaining in this shooting gallery where every passing moment brought him closer to untimely death. If he survived the night, Mach vowed, he would have nothing more to do with Napier or Andrastis. He would slip away from them at the first opportunity and fly to Switzerland, where he had ample cash and travel papers in three different names. Asia was lost to him, but that still left five continents, a world in which to lose himself and spend the rest of his life in reasonable comfort without dreading every telephone call, each knock on the door. They might hunt him at first, the Chinese or his two erstwhile partners, but Mach had faith in his ability to throw the trackers off his scent. The trick would be escaping from Tira, then ditching Napier and the Greek before they could draw him into another mad scheme. He hoped that it wasn't too late already, but he couldn't concentrate on that, not yet. Mach needed all of his resolve and courage to survive the next few hours.
Scared, are we, Mr. Mach?
What the hell was that?
Grenades? Jesus!
We're almost there.
I hope so. Christ, I didn't know you were one of the fucking mole people!
You surprise me, Arnold.
Oh yeah, how's that?
So high-strung, so nervous all the time. Amazed you've come this far in business.
High-strung my ass. Let these wild men chase you for a couple of weeks and we'll see how calm you are.
I trust that won't be necessary. We should be able to resolve this matter tonight, once and for all.
They had almost reached the downward sloping tunnel's end. Up ahead, another short staircase led to a door around eye level. They reached the foot of the staircase.
Here we are.
Where's here?
Have patience, my friend. It won't be long now.
The Greek's houseman mounted the stairs, pistol in hand, and opened the door. He checked whatever lay beyond, stepping across the silent threshold, then came back and waved for the others to follow. Moments later, they were standing inside some sort of garage. In place of normal cars, however, the rectangular building was filled wall-to-wall with motorcycles, four-wheel all-terrain vehicles, and several larger vehicles resembling golf carts. Napier surveyed their choice of getaway machines.
What's this? We're going golfing now?
Mind your manners, Arnold. You know there's no golf course on Tira.
Mind my... Listen, you son of a...
Andrastus racked the shotgun slide and turned to face Napier. The oil man's bodyguard surged forward, cocking weapons of their own. Another heartbeat found them ringed by more guns, ready to explode. Muck closed his eyes and wished he knew a simple prayer.
Is this the way you want to end it, Arnold? I'd have thought you were intelligent enough to save yourself, at least.
What are we doing, then?
I've answered that already. We're going to the Aristotle.
What, on these things?
Yes, unless you'd rather walk.
I'm getting fed up with being surprised, Christus. That's the bottom line.
Then let us hope the enemies you've led to my doorstep will stop surprising you.
Napier had no response to that, glaring past Lin Mach until Andrastus waved them toward the nearest golf cart. The Greek put on a brittle smile.
Gentlemen, please, take your seats.
Around the time guns had started going off, Grimaldi decided he couldn't sit offshore and watch the party from a distance. He'd already scoped the north side of the island through a pair of field glasses that had been left aboard the rented cruiser, picking out the yacht anchored in a sort of harbor there. It sat 100 yards offshore and something like a half mile from the house atop the island's highest ground. There was a risk involved, of course, and Bolin would be pissed off at his deviation from the plan. There'd be hell to pay if he blew it, but Grimaldi liked the odds. No lights at all were showing on the yacht, which told him that the crew had either gone ashore or was sacked out for the night. Smart Money said the crewmen would have used a launch to go ashore after the passengers offloaded and they finished their last-minute chores. It would have helped to have some law rockets aboard the cruiser, maybe a grenade launcher, but Grimaldi thought he could make do with his AKSU and a couple of thermite grenades he'd squirreled away from their perches in Athens, anticipating a possible need to torch the rented boat when they were finished with it. Now the incendiaries might be put to better use. Grimaldi hadn't spent much time at sea, but the cruiser's controls were rudimentary. He'd had plenty of practice on the trip out from Athens, getting used to the console before he had to manage under fire, with friends depending on him. As he turned for shore now, all that really troubled him was the possibility of an armed watchman dozing on board the yacht, or the greater likelihood of his being spotted by lookouts ashore. In either case, he guessed it wouldn't matter now that battle had been joined on Tira, and the shit had most definitely hit the fan. Pulling into the small cove, he throttled back and brought the cruiser slowly in beside the yacht. He left some 20 feet between the vessels, eyeballing the decks for any sign of movement now, but all the action seemed to be ashore. If there was anyone aboard the yacht, Grimaldi reasoned, they'd have been awake and topside by now, checking out the fireworks. He cocked the AKSU and left its safety off, slinging the short rifle over his shoulder for easy access. Grimaldi left the cruiser idling in neutral and palmed the two thermite grenades as he left the wheelhouse, stepping up to the boat's starboard railing. The ghostly white yacht, Aristotle, he saw from its name on the bow, rode silently at anchor, almost close enough to touch. He pulled the first grenade's pin and flicked it over the side, cocking his arm for a pitch toward the pleasure craft's stern. That's where the fuel would be, he reasoned, or close enough. Once the thermite got started, it would burn through decks and bulkheads as if they were cardboard until it found seawater and turned it to steam. Fire in the hole! He tossed the grenade. Bolin was pinned down, still 40 yards out from the house. He lay behind a tree, hugging the turf, while interlocking fire from 3 or 4 automatic weapons chewed up the soil and undergrowth about him, sprinkling him with leaves and shredded bark. The home team had reacted more cohesively than he'd expected when the shooting started from a Carter section of the line. He'd shown himself, emerging from the trees and moving toward the villa, but the mercs had come from nowhere, nearly tagging him before he scuttled back to cover under fire. Whatever happened in the next few minutes, Bolin thought the Greek had got his money's worth. At one level, it seemed a shame to kill such men, but they had chosen sides, the wrong one in this case, and they were standing in his way. Because there was no way around them, he would have to take them down, unless one of them caught a lucky break and tagged him first. Risking a glance around the tree, Bolin drew fire and jerked back, swiping mulch and sawdust from his eyes. Too close. But if he couldn't even spot his targets, how could he return fire and reduce their numbers? Shake them up, that was how. He carried the grenades clipped to his belt, Bolin ignored the frags and chose one of the thermite canisters. It wasn't made for anti-personnel work, but he knew he wouldn't have a chance to drop it on his enemies precisely. Shrapnel from a frag grenade was limited in range, and much of it flew upward when the charge exploded in an open space, like the expansive lawn in front of him. White phosphorus, by contrast, gave off smoke and heat. Its flash was certain to distract his adversaries for a moment, even if it didn't singe their flesh. He yanked the pin and made a sidearm pitch, lobbing the canister some 40 feet in front of him and toward the house. He rolled out to his left, around the east side of the tree. Somehow, he'd caught one of the shooters in the open, maybe rushing up to take him by surprise. The tables turned when the white-hot flash enveloped him. The guy was now dancing a crazy reel across the lawn, beating at flames an ocean wouldn't quench. Thermite would burn in water, underground, in outer space. It was the devil's breath, and there was no escape. Bolin let the flaming scarecrow run, seeking his comrades. One of them was kneeling on the grass some 30 feet away, gaping in horror as his sidekick stumbled past. Before he could recover his composure, Bolin put him down for good. That left one more, at least. Bolin spied him off to the right, dodging through a haze of chemical smoke, making a run for the tree line. The executioner led the runner, craning for the shot, and cut his legs from under him with a burst of 5.45mm rounds. The gunman fell across his line of fire, twitching as Bolin stroked the AKSU's trigger one more time to finish it. He rose, preparing to advance across the smoking lawn, but froze there.
What the hell?
Turning toward the noise, Bolin saw a four-wheeled ATV burst into view, swerving along a paved track through the trees, running downhill in the direction of the shoreline. Two more came behind it, gunmen in the saddle, and behind the ATVs, a pair of golf carts, their electric motors purring. Bolin saw a Chinese face turn toward the house, toward him, before the first cart vanished on its downhill run. Lin Mok? Who else?
Damn it!
The executioner ran after the retreating vehicles.
Mindel, McCarter, I got Mok in my sights.
Heads up! Our targets are running on wheels toward the bay. I'm in pursuit.
Damn!
McCarter slammed a fresh magazine into his Kalashnikov's receiver and jacked the slide. Huddled behind a massive poolside barbecue constructed out of brick and black wrought iron, he wondered what he was supposed to do next. How many of their targets were escaping? All of them? Should he fall back and join the chase? More to the point, could he withdraw while three or four opponents sprayed his precarious cover with gunfire? A continued assault on the house was pointless, but that didn't change McCarter's situation. Before he could retreat and join the chase, he'd have to take out those who'd pinned him down with streams of interlocking fire. They were using submachine guns, all 9mm by the sound of them, at least two firing from inside the house, while another lay behind a kind of cabana, belly down on the pavement and sniping at McCarter across the deep end of the swimming pool. Engaging any one of them meant exposing himself to another, unless... McCarter calculated distance while he unclipped a thermite grenade from his belt. Call it 20 feet from his position to the glass doors facing on the patio, where two or more of his enemies had gone to ground. They posed the greater threat, with concentrated firepower, and McCarter also recognized that his incendiary device would have a greater impact on the house than on bare concrete and tile. He hefted the grenade, rehearsing the pitch mentally before he pulled the pin and lobbed the canister overhand toward the house. It didn't have to land directly on his targets or even penetrate the house, but the closer it came to his marks, the more effective it would be.
Fucking grenade!
McCarter rolled out to the right of the barbecue, keeping the brickwork between himself and the cabana gunner. Peering through the smoke, he saw that one of his adversaries had taken a thermite hit, rolling on the floor and bashing at his torso with both hands, while the other was up and retreating to safety. McCarter helped the second shooter reach his final destination with a short burst to the spine that punched him through the pall of smoke and out of sight. He crab-walked back to see how the cabana shooter liked the fireworks, ducking as another burst of Parabellum Stingers rattled past his face.
Damn it! The bastard hasn't budged!
This time, McCarter palmed a frag grenade and drew the pin, holding the safety spoon firmly in place. McCarter waited for the blast and storm of shrapnel to pass before he broke cover, rushing the cabana in a sprint. The shooter from the home team wasn't wounded, but he ducked long enough to keep from getting stung. Returning to his vantage point, he blinked to find his target closing fast and tried to use his Uzi SMG. Too late. McCarter stitched him with a rising burst that laid the shooter on his back, awash in blood. McCarter fell back, running across the patio and into the trees, seeking a shortcut that would take him to Tira's Harbor. Whoa! The golf cart veered around a corner, nearly pitching Lin Mok from his seat. He clutched the cushion underneath him, hands like talons threatening to rip the vinyl upholstery. Beside him, Napier sat hunched forward on the small bench seat. His bodyguards were in the next cart back. They had covered roughly half the distance from the garage to the beach, a trio of mercenaries leading the procession on their snorting ATVs. Christos Andrastos sat beside the driver of Mach's cart, the shotgun braced across his lap.
Security? You call this security?
I call it your responsibility, and I grow tired of your complaints.
Oh, really?
Mach placed a hand on Napier's rigid arm. The oil man turned on him, livid, but seemed to think better of his next comment when Mach shook his head, a silent warning. They were in enough danger already, without forcing a quarrel and spilling blood among themselves.
How long before we reach the pier?
We are almost there, Mach.
And so they were. The Greek had barely spoken when their paved track left the trees and leveled off to parallel a beach. Mach craned his neck to see ahead and recognized the dock where they had landed only hours earlier. Offshore, the Aristotle waited for them, dark and silent, with a smaller craft positioned off her port side amidships. Mach pointed, leaning forward as their cart sped toward the pier.
Christos, shouldn't the other boat come in and...
Christos, what the hell?
Andrastos fired a shotgun blast. Mach gaped in shock as a fireball erupted near the Aristotle's stern. He was amazed the shot could reach that far, much less do so much damage to the mighty vessel. Another explosion rocked the yacht an instant later. No shot from Andrastos this time. The Aristotle's stern was all ablaze now, flames reflected on the water for 100 yards around. Andrastos slapped his driver's arm and pointed toward the pier.
Move it, you moron!
I'm driving as fast as this goddamn pokey thing will go!
The driver's head swiveled as he searched for enemies on the beach or at the tree line above them. They reached the pier seconds later. This blast seemed to emanate from somewhere deep below decks of the Aristotle, the vessel listing to port and settling deeper in the water. From his seat in the cart, Mach saw the smaller boat swinging clear of the stricken yacht. The Greek's mercenaries opened fire from shore.
Enough! They're out of range. Okay, what's plan B?
To stay alive and avoid our enemies ashore until more transport can be summoned.
Well, what about the launch?
Be my guest. It has fuel enough for 10 or 12 miles, then you drift.
I'll take my chances, Christos.
Yes, my friend, you will.
The mercenaries closed ranks with Andrastos as he spoke, blocking Napier and his four men from the pier.
But you will take them here, with us.
So this is how you treat your partners?
Those who bring the devil to my doorstep and then try to run away, perhaps. You're fortunate I care enough to save you from yourself.
Oh, don't do me any favors, Christos.
We have a chance to stay alive, but not at sea with 3 or 4 men drifting in a boat where they already have a vessel waiting. Stop and think. I know a man on Crete, a helicopter pilot. He will come for us if I ask him.
And how do you plan to do that? Shout across the ocean?
Andrastos smiled and slipped the cell phone from his pocket.
You surprise me, Arnold. I assumed you'd be familiar with the marvels of technology.
All right. So make your call. But can we do it on the move? I don't like standing here where any bastard with a piece can pick us off.
Bola knew he couldn't have outrun speeding ATVs, and while it might have been a toss-up with the golf carts over a limited distance, they had a lead he couldn't close by sticking to the paved road they were following. Instead, after some yards, he took a chance and veered off through the trees, crashing down the slope toward where he knew the med lay waiting for him, dark and still. For all he knew, there could be tripwires, gullies, muddy slopes waiting to spill him, weaponless, with broken bones, down to the beach. And still he ran, trusting the pull of gravity to give him extra speed. Sprinting downhill was always faster if a runner didn't twist a knee or snap his ankle, trip on something in the undergrowth, and crack his skull against a tree or stone. It wasn't skiing, granted, but he made good time, angling across the slope as he descended, making for the pier that had to be the jumping-off point for his target's flight by water. When he was halfway down the wooded slope, the explosion came from somewhere in front of him. The house was at his back and well above him, telling Bolan that the blasts had emanated from somewhere at sea, north of the island. He immediately thought of Jack Grimaldi on the cruiser, wondering if a patrol boat had surprised him after all, or if he'd run too close to shore and met disaster from a lookout with some weapon that could reach him from the beach. When he was near the bottom of the slope, Bolan saw firelight through the trees, reflecting on the harbor's glassy surface. From the tree line, he could see the source, a once great vessel now engulfed in flame for nearly half its length and plainly sinking. Water boiled around the stern as if the hull was breached and flooding her below decks, but it couldn't quench the fire topside. Even from a distance, Bolan recognized the smell and glare of thermite, and he glimpsed the cruiser nosing out of firelight into darkness there beyond the breakwater.
Grimaldi. Right.
But he wasn't the victim in this piece. He was the player who exceeded his directions and, at least this time, might well have saved the day. 300 yards downrange, he saw the carts and ATVs parked on the grass and sand around the pier. He didn't bother counting heads. However many of his enemies were there, Bolin would have to take them all. If Mindel and McCarter couldn't help him, then he'd try it on his own.
I'm on my way. Have you caught them yet?
They're at the pier. Jack scuttled their ride.
Good job. I'm there in 5, if you can leave me, Sam.
No promises.
Bolin started down the beach. It troubled him that they'd heard nothing more from Mindel, but he didn't chase the thought. There could be any number of reasons for her continued silence. Bolin refused to write her off so easily, but neither could he count on her for help right now, when their primary target stood before him and he found himself alone. Even McCarter's 5 minutes might put him on the scene too late, if Napier and the others had a backup plan in place. But it looked like they were arguing among themselves. He saw it now, drawing encouragement from the delay that let him close the gap between them. It would be too much to hope they'd shoot each other while he watched. But if they only stalled a little longer... No such luck. His quarry began piling back into their vehicles.
God damn it!
Desperate, refusing to be left behind, Bolin found more speed somewhere inside himself, sprinting through dappled moonlight toward the pier.
Driver, follow the beach due west. Give me time to make the call.
The cart lurched into motion for a jerky start, rear wheels digging briefly at the sand. Then they were moving. Andrastas let the shotgun rest across his lap, glancing back at the Aristotle's flaming hulk as he punched the number into his cell phone.
Yes?
Andrastas here. I have immediate need of your assistance on the island.
Yes, sir. I'll be right there.
Andrastas' driver suddenly slumped forward over the steering wheel. Andrastas, still clutching his cell phone, spun around in his seat. He spotted a gunman sprinting after them along the beach.
Get that bastard, you idiots!
Andrastas' bodyguards started pulling away on their ATVs.
Come back and fight!
Andrastas triggered 2 quick shotgun blasts that brought them back, making U-turns on the beach and narrowly avoiding collisions with one another, like members of some inept motorcycle drill team.
Now stop that bastard!
Andrastas used the shotgun as a lever, shoving his dead driver out of the cart. He scooted across to the driver's seat.
Napier, Mark, hang on. We're not done yet.
It crossed his mind that his business partners were dead weight now, slowing the cart. But then Andrastas thought of them as shields, a fleshy wall to block his adversary's aim, and he felt better about taking them along for the ride. The second cart fell in behind them, racing west along the beach through darkness, looking for a place to hide.
Heads up. Our targets are running on wheels toward the bay. I'm in pursuit.
The bullet missed Rebecca Mindel's face by fractions of an inch, came close enough to warm her cheek in passing, causing her to recoil and return fire, a burst from her AKSU, making the sniper dance before he collapsed in a lifeless heap.
Come in, Blansky! Come in, Blansky! Oh, shit! What's wrong?
Mindel found a snapped-off sprig of wire and plastic where her microphone had been a moment earlier.
Damn it!
She left the dead man where he'd fallen and the house in flames, retreating toward the island's northern shoreline. It struck her as bad business, leaving sentries still alive around the house, but they were pawns and strictly low priority. If Napier and the other VIPs were slipping through the net, her place was with the other members of her team to stop their quarry from escaping one more time. It seemed a long run to the beach, though it was downhill nearly all the way, no farther than a quarter mile. She had to watch her step, afraid of crippling injuries as she ran on through the trees and darkness. The sounds of combat kept Mindel on course. Finally, as Mindel cleared the last 20 yards, she could see muzzle flashes, bobbing headlight beams, and the reflected glow of fire on water. She burst through the tree line in time to see 4 all-terrain vehicles roar past her, weaving zigzag patterns on the sand as they raced toward a lone figure standing away to her right.
Blansky?
She knew it had to be. Her next action was automatic. Swiveling to track the ATVs, Mindel triggered a burst from her Kalashnikov that spilled the nearest rider from his saddle. The 4-wheeled vehicle ignored his passing and ran on without him, albeit losing speed and swerving toward the surf. The remaining hunters missed her entry into the battle, so intent on riding down their target. All of them were firing at Blansky now, the black-clad warrior answering in kind as he dodged toward the tree line and cover. Mindel stepped farther out onto the sand and raised her weapon, sighting down the barrel after her retreating enemies. The next nearest was rising from his seat, firing at Blansky with a stubby SMG, an MP5K or a mini Uzi. Bracing the AKSU's folding stock against her shoulder, Mindel triggered a burst that ripped into her target's shoulder and sent his weapon cartwheeling across the sand, while he slumped across the ATV's handlebars. Still, the shooter hung on, fighting for control of his vehicle and grappling it to a halt on the sand. Slumping to his left, he dropped from the saddle and put the ATV between them, shielding himself for a moment while he tried to draw a pistol left-handed. Mindel didn't give him time to get there. She drilled the fuel tank. The wounded gunner vaulted to his feet and headed for the surf in a clumsy, shambling run. Mindel used the last half-dozen rounds in her weapon to drop him short of the water. She faced eastward, in time to see Boland finish the last of the mounted assassins. The tall man moved to join her, Mindel staying where she was and glancing backward to the west, where a pair of golf carts were fast receding out of range.
The VIPs are all aboard there. We have to catch them.
Sudden crashing from the tree line brought them both around, twin weapons tracking toward the source of the sound.
McCarter.
Bloody hell! Don't tell me that I've missed the show.
Not yet. The last act's on the road.
All right. What are we waiting for?
Napier glanced back fearfully along the beach. Fuming, he turned back to Andrastus, himself busy steering the golf cart.
Your strike force is shot to hell. Next bright idea?
We still have men and guns. You give up too easily.
Give up? In case you had noticed, we just got our asses kicked back there.
The helicopter is on its way. We're to meet it at the west end of the island.
Great. Now that's if we're still alive, I take it.
You can go your own way any time, Arnold. I can't slow down for you, of course. Feel free to jump.
Just hurry up, goddammit!
We're at top speed now. Sit back and shut up, or I will stop.
Napier felt Lin Mok watching him, but wouldn't meet his Chinese partner's gaze. Napier had no more slick solutions up his sleeve, and while he hated finding himself at the Greek's mercy, there was no other way off his island of death. Napier swiveled in his seat again and looked back toward the pier, then past it to the latest killing ground. Two of the ATVs were moving, and at first, it gave him hope, making him think he'd misinterpreted the images his eyes had picked out from the shadows and confusion on the beach. Maybe the Greek security detachment had been victorious after all. That desperate hope vanished as the ATVs came racing after them, running swift and straight along the beach.
But fucking shit!
The rider in front started shooting at them. Napier knew they were in trouble.
They're chasing us on our own goddamn bikes!
What?
Andrastus looked back and blinked at their pursuers, then faced forward and bent over the golf cart steering wheel, as if his posture could gain them extra speed. Two of Napier's gunmen in the second golf cart were already returning fire, dueling with the ATV riders. Napier leaned across the back of his own cart.
$100,000 to the man who takes him out! $100,000 each!
At that, the driver of the second cart slammed on the brakes and grabbed his own weapon, stepping down from his seat to the sand and turning to face the enemy. Around him, the others piled out and did likewise, forming a skirmish line across the beach.
What have you done?
Just what it looks like, old son. I bought us some time.
At least he hoped that was the case, but with Andrastus at the wheel, he wasn't sure. Their cart seemed incapable of doing better than 20 or 25 miles per hour, while the ATVs were capable of twice that speed. Heedless of the shotgun now, he poked Andrastus in the ribs.
Hurry up, for Christ's sakes! We don't have all night!
Boland had one of the ATVs to himself, while Mindel rode double with McCarter. Hunched forward on the buddy seats and firing past him as they chased their quarry westward, with the glassy sea off to their right, dark forest looming on the left. Boland himself squeezed off a short one-handed burst, but wasn't happy with the AKSU's kick and concentrated on his steering as they closed the gap. He ducked when gunners in the second cart began returning fire, then switched off his headlight to make their job harder. Beside him, McCarter did likewise, while Mindel kept firing short bursts for effect. She hadn't scored yet, as far as Boland could tell, when the second cart wavered, then lurched to a halt, its passengers hopping out with weapons in hand.
Here we go!
Deprived of options, Boland braced his Kalashnikov across the ATV's handlebars and started down the beach, McCarter joining in as they raced toward the enemy picket line. 60 yards. 50. 40. At 30 and counting, the skirmish line broke, two of the shooters crumpling where they stood, two others breaking for the trees, while the last leaped back into the golf cart and gunned it for safety. Too late. Boland veered toward the tree line and the runners. McCarter and Mindel rode up on the cart driver's blindside and shot him to tatters, leaving him dead at the wheel. Boland's targets had given up fighting, but he strafed them anyway, dropping one on the sand, catching the second with a lucky shot just as he reached the trees. As he swung back from the trees, rejoining the second ATV, Boland registered the chill sensation of cold liquid splashing his thigh. A downward glance showed him the clean hole where a bullet had pierced his fuel tank, gasoline jetting out in a simulated arterial spray.
Shit!
Bolin used his teeth to tear a strip of fabric from his sleeve, throttling back while he wadded it up in one hand and wedged it as a makeshift plug into the bullet hole. It was all he could do, but the ATV's fuel gauge was edging toward empty. He didn't know what kind of mileage the vehicle got, but guessed there were 10 or 15 minutes worth of fuel left in the tank at the outside. Bolin racked his brain for details of Brignola's satellite photos. He knew that less than half of Tira's northern coastline featured beaches, the rest a line of rocky crags where breakers threw themselves against sea-scoured stone around the block. And while he couldn't see the far end of the beach yet, lost in darkness up ahead, he knew his adversaries had to be running out of road. Ahead of Bolin, the cart's driver appeared to panic, swerving toward the tree line for security. It was a serious mistake. The cart lost speed and traction all at once, sand spurting from beneath its fat rear tires. The driver tried to gun it, and the cart tipped over. Bolin slowed as its three occupants scrambled clear, one of them squeezing off a shotgun blast in his general direction. He couldn't tell if the others were packing, but Bolin took it for granted. Better safe than gut shot by an unarmed man. The executioner gunned the ATV and kicked free of its saddle at the same time, leaving the four-wheeler to roll on without him, losing most of its momentum before it collided with the capsized golf cart. Bolin saw his target scatter, one breaking for the woods, one toward the surf, the third sprinting on down the beach. Afoot, he took the nearest of the three, noting the shotgun in his target's hands. Behind him, Mendel hastily dismounted and pursued the runner who seemed bent on hiding in the sea, McCarter racing on after the third man. Bolin's adversary turned briefly to face him. He missed with both shots, then dropped his empty weapon, drawing something from his belt. The executioner knelt and tracked him with the AKSU, leading just enough to make it count. Bolin trotted forward and found Christos Andrastas stretched out on the sand, a cell phone clutched in his right fist. He had no other weapon.
Mr. Andrastas, I'm on my way.
You're too late.
Bolin pitched the phone toward the trees. He turned. He saw Rebecca Mendel wading back to shore, knee-deep in foam, reloading her Kalashnikov.
Lin Mak, I guess he thought he could swim back to China.
How's that working out for him?
Not so well.
They both faced westward, marking the taillights of McCarter's ATV no more than 100 yards distant. They found McCarter 30 yards beyond the ATV, standing atop a bluff that faced the sea. He peered down into thrashing darkness where the breakers hissed and fumed on jagged rocks.
Where's Napier?
Crazy bugger went over the side.
It was a drop of 40 feet or so from where they stood. Bolin leaned over, staring into the void, marking the place where waves drew phosphorescent patterns on the rocks. For just a moment, he imagined a pale face uplifted on the swell, then dashed against the cliff and sucked away. It didn't reappear, and after counting off 2 minutes, he drew back. He had counted on seeing the oil man dead, but there was nothing to be done about it now. They could drag the sea until doomsday and still find no vestige of Arnold Napier. Perhaps it was better that way.
We finished here?
Suits me.
Yes.
Good.
Bolin keyed his microphone.
Floater, do you read me?
5x5, where and when?
The pier?
Okay.
Why not?
We could have company along the way.
Well, that's their problem.
The pier, Floater, if you're finished bombing yachts.
I'm on my way.
Jerusalem. The bus stopped at the summit of Mount Herzl to disgorge its passengers. Every seat had been filled for the ride from downtown Jerusalem, the passengers riding in reverent near silence to their destination. Those who spoke at all did so in whispers, as if fearing to disturb their fellow travelers. From the bus stop, it was a 10-minute walk over sun-baked pavement to Yad Vashem, the Israeli memorial complex dedicated to Holocaust martyrs and heroes. Bolin made the walk that morning with Rebecca Mendel, David McCarter, and Jack Grimaldi, the four of them taking their time while others hurried on to make their guided tour of the facility. Bolin and his three companions were here on a private errand. They needed no tour guide to show them around or remind them of how they should feel. 2 days had passed since they scourged the island of Tira with fire, and reports of the event had waffled through a 180-degree rotation, helped along with strategic news leaks from the States and Tel Aviv. Initially, it was reported that Christos Andrastos and a group of unknown guests had been attacked by terrorists and massacred on Tyra. But later accounts suggested the Greek and his visitors had been engaged in some criminal conspiracy, the details left deliberately vague, when competitors from a rival syndicate had crashed the party and wreaked havoc with the home team. At the moment, while Bolan and his friends approached the solemn Hall of Remembrance, Greek police were scouring Tyra for survivors and evidence of a far-reaching plot that imperiled Greek security and her relationship with Israel. Various employees of the Andrastos shipping empire were already in custody, along with certain executives of Global Petroleum, arrested in New York, Jakarta, and Cairo. No mention of a nuclear device or global terrorism reached the press. Charges could always be finessed as the legal proceedings dragged on. Andrastos was already dead, Arnold Napier listed as missing, though no one appeared to be pursuing him. No ID was available for the Chinese national found washed up on the beach a quarter mile west of the point where Andrastos' yacht, the Aristotle, had burned and sunk. Beijing officially ignored the whole affair, but rumors of a small-scale party purge in progress were reported by observers in the field to CIA headquarters and the White House. It was cool inside Yad Vashem's Hall of Names, where some 3.2 million victims of the Nazi Holocaust were memorialized. That still left nearly half of the Third Reich's Jewish victims unidentified. But the collection of names was ongoing, as it had been since 1955, and would remain in perpetuity. Adjacent to the Hall of Names, another chamber held the pages of testimony penned by survivors of those slain, preserved as mazavoth, literally tombstones for the dead. Bolan had toured the Holocaust Museum in Washington and found it moving, but there'd still been something distant about that memorial, built as it was on American soil, so far removed from the scene of the crime. Granted, Jerusalem was nearly as far from the killing fields of Poland, Germany, and Russia as the District of Columbia, but Israel itself was a kind of living memorial to the victims of those dark years, lending a greater immediacy to the sacrifice.
Uncle Yaakov visited this place a week before the madness began in Tel Aviv. He called it the heart of our nation. I never quite thought of it that way before.
McCarter scanned the walls inscribed with names surrounding an eternal flame that flickered in the middle of the room.
It's easy to forget.
Here too. It's before us always, in our fiction, art, and history, of course. But current events always seem to take precedence. Today's victims and tomorrow's overshadow the past.
For what it's worth, there'll be fewer victims tomorrow, thanks to Katz. Thanks to you.
It doesn't matter what I've done. But he would be pleased to hear you say that. He was never far from Israel in his heart, I think. Even when he was traveling around the world.
It makes me wonder, though.
Wonder?
If we ever really make a difference. All these dead. And some folks say it could have been avoided if Hitler was killed at the start. Somehow, I can't help thinking that some other monster would have come along to take his place. I mean, it feels inevitable somehow, if you follow me.
Perhaps it was. I need to say Kaddish. Excuse me, please. I won't be long.
Take your time.
She knelt before a railing near the flame and began to intone the Hebrew prayer for the dead.
Yit kadav, yit kadash me rabah.
Bolan didn't understand a word of it, but the recitation still had a visceral power, drawn from Mindel's faith and from her grief. In some small measure, Bolan knew those attributes reflected the soul of a nation besieged, fighting for its life for more than half a century from the day it was born. Fighting forever? Endless war? He knew the feeling from personal experience. The bitter loss and lust for vengeance, tempered into something more enduring than revenge. The soul of a crusade. Where would the battle take him after this? Would he prevail? Surrounded by the dead, Mac Bolan closed his eyes in homage to a fallen friend. Tomorrow's enemies would come when they were ready. And the executioner would be there, waiting for them. One more battle in the everlasting war. It was his promise to the dead.
Mac Bolan Retaliation is a graphic audio production. Mac Bolan is a trademark owned by Harlequin Enterprises Limited, used by others under license. Copyright 2003, Worldwide Library, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2006, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Performed by Terrence Aselford, Richard Rowan, David Coyne, Nanette Savard, Casey Jones, Christopher Graybill, Ken Jackson, Karen Carbone, Thomas Penny, and Mort Shelby. Additional red shirts performed by The Dead Giveaways. Directed by Bob Supan. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Greg Reinfeld and Chris Rowan. The Mac Bolan theme was composed by Chris Rowan. Additional original music by Chris Rowan and Matt Webb. Book adapted for graphic audio by Gerald Rudolph. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. If you enjoyed Mac Bolan, be sure to look for Don Pendleton's Stony Man and The Executioner, available at Road Stops Everywhere, at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net. Keep listening for previews of other graphic audio thrillers.
The following previews are of graphic audio productions rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Panama, Guatemala, Mexico. They're pissed off and they're not going to take it anymore. United in their determination to reclaim their identity from rich elitists and corrupt politicians, the people stage national strikes. Miami, San Diego, Los Angeles. Cities swamped, literally and figuratively, with the pent-up anger and resentment of their southern neighbors. The borders are being overwhelmed, and with the National Guard's attention focused in the Middle East, there is very little to stop the hordes from storming the Yankee Nation. Cancun. The revolution has begun. From the sex and sun capital of Mexico, the insurgents, as masterminded by Diego Garcia, has been launched. Fueled by a desire for revenge, backing from Cuba and China, and the knowledge that his time is running out, he initiates his plans for immortality.
The hostages, the women and children, use them as human shields! My plan is working, and I will not have it disrupted for any reason! Viva la revolution!
Mommy!
May I ask what you plan to do with them after the attack?
They are going to die along with the rest of the Yankees. I'm not going to exempt the females so they can breed even more enemies of the people. We have too many enemies as it is.
Of course, comrade. That is only fitting.
Against this environment of border state chaos fueled by Garcia's insanity, Mac Bolan has a mission to recover a package. Pal Brognola, the head of Stony Man Farm. Bolan's mission quickly escalates to include securing the safety of thousands of hostages, second-guessing the actions of a madman, and fighting for the integrity of American soil and freedom.
Okay, my partner and I will clear the terrorists off the deck for you. When we've thinned them out, I'll give you the go. Run straight out, dive off the deck, and start swimming. The guards along the sides will try to shoot at you, so stay underwater as long as you can. Got it?
Let's do it.
Thank you. Thank you. They were going to kill us, and you saved us.
You should have stayed in Cuba, compadre. Communism's dead. And now, so are you.
Mac Bolan works night and day to protect the United States of America. But he isn't the only one. The government has had long-standing agents in the field with vital agendas.
Okay, Stryker. What do you know about Project Zodiac?
I've heard rumors. Some sort of doomsday plan from the Cold War.
That's damn close. 12 deep cover agents scattered across Europe, each equipped with a compact nuclear device that fits into a standard-sized briefcase. Each of these has a full 1/4 kiloton yield. Very nasty stuff. Dirty as hell.
But when the unexpected happens...
The bastards got them. Zalharis and his crew stole the entire shipment of Zodiacs.
A band of Brazilian mercenaries known as the Scion hold the trigger on four weapons of mass destruction. And they're bringing them on American soil.
These are kamikaze models. Damage the casing, and even if it's not already armed, the bomb will detonate automatically. The Zodiacs have to be recovered intact and undamaged.
The threat is real, and the bloodthirsty mercenaries are already here. Bolin will have to scour the states to track down the heartless killers. And even at the top of his game, he can't be everywhere at once.
Did they just toss something overboard? Why on earth is that?
In the Scion's unholy sail, death goes to the highest bidder. Don't miss 1 minute of Mac Bolin 96. Stolen Arrows.
If you can't find that hot graphic audio title you're looking for, just head to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD or MP3 disc format. Or, the fastest and cheapest way, download that puppy and play it on any of the many devices that'll play Windows Media. And if you're on the road or just a total computer feeb, snatch up the phone and call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.